It is just simply as it is that we affirm. So we are not tasked here as a congregation to tell people who they should be or tell them who they are. But yet we have been given the great opportunity to affirm how people see themselves and believe that they are. And we take that task very seriously. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy this event today, and welcome to this place.
Thank you. That was our minister, Stephen Robinson. Did you introduce yourself? So that's our part-time minister, Stephen Robinson. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining our program today on Thinking Outside the Gender Box. My name is Laura Hartwig, and I'm the Social Action Committee Chair here at UUCC. I'm excited to see so many people here. And first, a big thank you to our kitchen committee who helped us with a snack before the event. I'd also like to thank our speakers today for taking part of this event. Dana Smith, Nathaniel Naomi Simmons-Thorne, Greg Green, and Linda Brennison. And Dana will also be our moderator besides just a speaker today. You all know that UUCC is a welcoming congregation, and we embrace LGBTQ individuals. Many of us are comfortable with gay and lesbian community, but we don't have that much experience with the transgender community. Today, I'd like you to listen to the voices of transgender individuals and family as they share their experiences. If you have questions for any of our panelists today, write them down on the note cards that are on your table and raise your hand and someone will pick them up for you. We will cover them during our Q&A session after the presentations. Hopefully, most of you, I think, were able to join us earlier for my pulpit talk on embracing transformation, and we covered some of the basic terminology then and concepts, and I have handouts. If you'd like to have those, just let me know and I'll get you a handout. One of the biggest takeaways from my talk today was the fact that gender is much more complicated than the male-female binary. Some people don't feel that sex was that assigned to them at birth matches their true gender identity. These people are considered transgender. Some feel that comfortable in a male or female gender identity body, but some are somewhere in between. Some are fluid in between genders. Some consider themselves neither gender or a third gender. It's important to realize that these are all legitimate identities, and people whose sex assigned at birth matches their gender identity are called cisgender or cis. Another big takeaway is that sexual orientation has nothing to do with gender identity. A trans person might consider themselves gay, straight, bisexual, or asexual. Gender identity has nothing to do with sexual orientation, and they're two completely different things. And the final point that I want to make before giving the floor to our speakers today is that we need to unlearn that what we were taught as children, that gender is about your genitals. We need to understand that gender describes who you are. You can be a man, a woman, somewhere in between, or neither. All those are okay. I think that most people expect a trans person who passes as cisgender to admit that they are transgender because they are somehow otherwise fooling us. But unlike coming out in an LGBT context, where the act of disclosing one's sexual orientation reveals the truth about the person's sexual orientation, disclosing one's trans status often has the opposite effect. That is, when a person comes out as trans, the listener often assumes the truth about the trans person is that they are somehow more fundamentally a member of their birth sex rather than the gender they have chosen to live in. In other words, sometimes coming out makes it more difficult for a trans person to be fully recognized as the gender they are living in. And would we expect a person who got a nose job to reveal that they were born with a different nose? No. And frankly, I think we're all adult enough here to understand that there are enough different ways to have sex so that if you love someone, what genitals you have don't really matter. I keep hearing about the search for realness from trans folk. And my sense is that we as cisgender people don't allow them to be their authentic selves. And because of that, among transgender people, the attempted suicide rate is 41%. This has to change, and it can start with us. So now I'm going to turn the floor over to our speakers. Our first speaker today is Dana Smith. Dana Smith's lived in Columbia, South Carolina since 1997 and is originally from Brevard, North Carolina. Hope I pronounce that right. Brevard. Okay. Dana attended Appalachian State. I'll try to keep my mouth closer to it. I'm probably like moving around. Is anybody would like hearing assistance? Okay, I'm going to try to keep this closer to my mouth, especially since I'm going to hand the microphone over to Dana in just a minute. So Dana attended Appalachian State University, where she received a BS, and then attended University of South Carolina, where she received an IMA. Dana currently works for a health insurance company, but in her spare time, she performs as a spoken word / slam poet under the stage name Alley Cat. Dana is actively involved at the Harriet Hancock Center in Columbia. Please welcome Dana.
Yeah, and just so that everyone in the back can see me, I'm just going to stand momentarily. For some of people here do know, in November I had a stroke, so energy's not always there, and my ability to stand for a length of time is not. So I'm just standing up so everybody in the back can see me. So I'm going to sit back down. Thank you, Laura. As she said, my role at the Harriet Hancock Center is I'm the transgender resource coordinator. What that means is if someone calls the center looking for a resource or something, and I never know from each call, email, text, what they're going to need. Maybe name change assistance, finding a doctor that does hormone replacement, a lawyer to assist on some issue. And unfortunately, the resources in Columbia are rather limited. You're probably, the three of us are probably three of the most active, most visible trans people in Columbia. And, yeah. And so it's doing the work. And I think one thing about doing the work is that it's unpaid work. It's purely volunteer for myself. And so it's the idea that I work a 40-hour-a-week job and spend anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week assisting people with what they need. I think that is, it's a challenge for the trans community. It's the getting to the point where we have our own resources and are able to actually be paid for our work. Because quite often it's just assumed that trans people or activists in general, even though it is a labor of love, you can't eat a labor of love. I have been in transition for 25 years. I consider for me transition a lifelong process. It's not something that's completed. It moves, it kind of ebbs and flows for me. I transitioned publicly at a time when transitioning publicly was not acceptable or condoned or supported. I've had my backlash over the years. I was outed 12 years ago at my work. And I have probably been paying for that since. Being at a company for 12 years and only get one promotion. And just recently, I was up for a position and general company procedures, you have to be in your current position for a year. And my division says 6 months. Well, I was actually not, I did not receive the position, and I've been in my job for 4 years, whereas I found out the person that got the job is a white, straight, cisgender male who had only been employed at the company for 4 months. And I even brought it up with my division's VP, and he just, yeah, that is kind of strange, but just didn't really have an answer for beyond that. So those are the kind of things that I've experienced. Also, some of the comments, just people over the years, I've been told, well, you're just really gay. No, I'm not. And as Laura was saying, sexuality and gender identity are independent phenomena. And even having to, and then explain that I have pretty much exclusively dated women. And it's like, and they say, well, why did you transition then? Because the gender identity as a woman, but I am also attracted to women. And so that was a struggle, because the idea that 15, 20 years ago, that the idea that they were separate, being able to separate, was a hard issue. I think looking at what's gone on, I think one current phenomenon that I'm seeing is that people are now financially preying upon the trans community. Because we, as the trans community, there are things that we have to do. Now, as insurance companies are covering trans health, doctors are charging higher than average prices for services. And because I actually, just as an example, prior to my stroke, I was scheduled to go to Thailand for my genital reconstructive surgery. And under my insurance was going to cover it. It is going to cover it. My out-of-pocket max for that trip with the hospital and all the doctors in the hotel in Thailand was only going to be $1,150. The total for my 3 weeks in the hospital for my stroke was over $6,000. So, and that is the insurance company passing on the savings to the member. And so we see that. And that even just brings up, I mean, it's part of a phenomenon of our healthcare system too. And unfortunately, the trans people that didn't want to get medical interventions, it becomes difficult just because of access and finance. So I think I could talk about myself for a while, but I'm going to actually, it's just when you've been at it for 25 years, you've got a lot to say. So I will pass it on to Naomi. So go ahead and let you introduce yourself.
Or that's like lower. Yeah.
Do you want to stay?
Okay, our second speaker is Nathaniel Naomi Themmons Thorne, an award-nominated student, writer, social justice educator, and activist organizer based out of Columbia, South Carolina. Naomi has participated in and led numerous community projects, campaigns, and organizing efforts within the state and her larger Southeast region. She has become a regularly requested speaker on social and political issues, and her ideas and analysis has been received by national and international audiences via television, radio, web, and print. Naomi is a rising scholar and in the fields of philosophy and the social sciences. Her academic areas of interest includes history and philosophy of social and political movements, race, feminism, and the construction and performance of masculinity. Please welcome Nathaniel Naomi.
Hi, everybody. So thank you for the introduction, and thank you as well, Dana, for everything that you've stated thus far. My name is Nathaniel Naomi, or Naomi for short. I use she, her pronouns, or they, them, theirs. I identify as a non-binary person. Sometimes I also refer to myself as trans feminine. So a lot of people are kind of confused about what that means. And for me, that means that I don't identify as either male or female, but I do embrace femininity as a kind of way of expressing myself. I think what's important to note about that is that words like transfeminine and transgender and non-binary, these words are descriptions, they're not definitions. And so they don't define who I am. They approximate to you the way I see myself and the way that I would like for people to relate to me. And so a lot of times this really confounds people, because being a non-binary person, you're asking people to kind of stretch the limitations of their socialization, and also what our institutions and what our society allows for. And so things like the gender binary and male-female boxes and these kind of things, they are really limited and only allow for a really narrow form of expression of humanity and creativity and personhood. And for me, my personhood expands far beyond the confines of just male or female. And that isn't to say that being a non-binary transgender person is in any way more, in any way better or more revolutionary or edgy or anything like that than being a transgender person who identifies as male or female. It's just a call to continue expanding what we believe to be possible and who we make room for at the table. And so making room also includes making room for people who don't have a defined seat yet. So that means that we have to continue expanding how we think about gender and what we know gender to be. And so I think many people are comfortable or have become more comfortable recently with the idea of accepting that gender exists on a spectrum and gender is more fluid and not as static as a lot of us were born to think. And a lot of us have come to accept the fact that someone who was assigned male at birth or was assigned female at birth might decide to transition or might not feel comfortable with accepting the gender identity that our society sanctions for them. But I think that also acknowledging the fact that maybe people might not want to be anywhere on that spectrum is also really important as well. And so a lot of my activism is around really destigmatizing what it means to be trans and expanding people's notions of what gender is. I think that's really important because gender is it's a really hard, superfluous thing to try to kind of describe or really put a finger on. A lot of it has to do with intuition. And so there isn't perfect language, especially in a setting like this, to really describe what gender is. And there, and theories of gender come from all over the place, depending on your discipline, your field. But I think what we can all agree to is that gender is something that's deeply personal, and the way that people see their gender, regardless of what our notions of gender might be, we should just respect how that person sees their gender. I've been really happy in the past couple of years because the representation of transgender folks has really skyrocketed, and transgender people have become more visible, and transgender issues are being platformed in a way that they never were previously. And that, to me, has shown remarkable improvement. Just the fact that we were invited here to the UU Church today to have this conversation also represents a monumental step in progress. Just last week, I believe it was, or probably 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure if anybody saw the news, but there was a really huge debacle with the Methodist Church after the Methodist Church decided that it would not openly or take an institutional stance of being an affirmative church or an affirmative space for LGBTQ people. So our resources like the UU Church and other affirmative churches are extremely important, primarily because churches and religious institutions play a pivotal role in spreading transphobia and antagonism against transgender people. In fact, religious spaces is where a lot of us learn to dislike trans people and learn to dislike gender diversity and diversity in sexual orientations and so on. And so I think that churches have a very unique responsibility in undoing that history and creating opportunities for dialogue and healing between members of the LGBTQ community and church spaces as well. Also because being a transgender person, being LGBTQ, does not in any way take away from your ability or erase the spiritual part of who you are. And a lot of transgender people are also Christian. A lot of transgender people, their first home was in a church. And a lot of trans people, a lot of LGBTQ folks tend to be pushed out of those spaces as they begin to deviate from traditional notions of gender and sexual orientation and so on. But I think here in the local community, there is a lot of work to be done. There's been progress, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Transgender people still face a lot of barriers, particularly here in the South and in South Carolina, that transgender folks do not face other places. I was born in New York City, and recently New York City passed a law that made it possible for non-binary folks to have a gender marker X where male or female would be on their birth certificates, license, and other documents. Because I was born in New York City, I was able to change that for myself, but had I been born in South Carolina, that would not have been possible. It's a process, and my change in birth certificate will probably come in 2 or 3 more months. But when it does come, I'm not exactly sure how that's going to transfer here to South Carolina because South Carolina doesn't recognize that. South Carolina, in January of last year, I decided to wear a dress to my job. And the thing about me is that I've noticed in comparison to a lot of my other transgender friends, particularly my transgender friends who identify as male or female, they, because the way that they present their gender is more consistent than the way that I present mine, there is a certain level of expectations and that they don't necessarily always have to put up with. So if I go to a job interview and I'm presenting closer to my assigned gender, the day I come to work, they're going to expect me to look like that. And the day that I decide not to look like that, it might be like a really huge problem. And that's kind of the predicament I found myself in last January when I decided to go to work in a dress. And something else about the way that I perform femininity, I don't shave my facial hair, which a lot of people seem to take an issue with. And so I went to work wearing this beautiful dress and I didn't have my face shaved. And you can only imagine the way that people, you can only imagine the way that that was received on the job. And so I remember that day, I actually was fired from my job for that reason. They took me into the office and was just like, this is going to be a disruption. We can't have this here. We wouldn't mind if you are transgender, you're going to have to pick a side. And then I'm like, what does that mean? And I have not been traditionally employed since then. But here in South Carolina, there's a lot of barriers and difficulties for transgender folks. And a part of my job as an activist is speaking to audiences and raising awareness about those difficulties. A lot of people don't know this, but 4 transgender people that I know in South Carolina died last year. 2 died from homicides and 2 committed suicide. Both of the transgender folks who committed suicide were under the age of 18. And the other two that were killed were actually both under the age of 35. And for Black transgender folks, we actually have particularly for Black trans feminine folks, we actually have a life expectancy of 35. There's a trans homicide epidemic that's currently going on that unless you're really plugged into the LGBTQ community, you might not know about. And so at a rate of about two people per month, transgender folks, mainly Black trans women, are being shot, killed, and otherwise brutalized or attacked. In Orangeburg of last year in Orangeburg, there was a Black transgender woman who was found burnt alive that you may or may not have heard about. And so there's a lot of violence against Black transgender folks, and these conversations allow us in the community to raise awareness about what's going on, what's being done to us, and it allows for us to start building bridges between communities. And so I think that's what's really important, building bridges, because transgender folks have been here. We will always be here. And we're not really going anywhere. In fact, transgender folks are just becoming more and more visible. So I'll just leave with the final words of just saying that as we move forward, I think it's really important that we are being affirmative, particularly church spaces, that we are being affirmative, that we're allowing for people to explore their gender identities and sexual orientations without fear, without being stigmatized. And last thing I would like to leave with before we get to the Q&A session was just really understand the unique kind of difficulties that Black transgender folks go through, because on top of racism and white supremacy and discrimination and all the other various ways that Black folks are marginalized in our society, when you add being transgender on top of that, it just makes it more difficult. So that's it for me, and I'll pass the mic over to Greg.
Thank you, Ryan. Our third speaker is Greg Green, a native of South Carolina. Greg graduated from the Citadel in 2006 with a degree in psychology. After working 5 years as a police officer and firefighter, he began in the trade business at FedEx. Greg has been a member of Tau Kappa Phi, Inc., a nonprofit LGBT Greek-lettered organization for 14 years. During this time, he helped create a space within Tau Kappa Phi for transgender men, Alpha Omega Kappa Fraternity, Inc., serving as the first president of the organization. Greg served as a moderator for the transgender support group at Garden of Grace United Church of Christ, and has been on the board of South Carolina Equality as a chairman of Trans Action Task Force. Please welcome Greg.
Never mind, I'll hold it. Good afternoon. Thank you all for having us. It's always good to see something like this happening, to see the change, to see that seek of knowledge, you know, that people want to know more about not just the trans community, but what can be done to help the trans community and support the trans community. I've been transitioning for 9 years. As it was mentioned, I graduated from the Citadel. I graduated from the Citadel in 2006. 2006 was the 10th year anniversary of the Citadel allowing women into the school. I graduated, I don't remember the number anymore, but the first 20 Black females to graduate from the Citadel, my previous name is in that number. So that definitely was not an easy task. I'd do it again, but it was definitely not an easy task. But I know now that it set me up for the non-easy task I would continue to have throughout my life. As far as transitioning, I've always known that I wanted to be a boy. I just didn't know what that meant. And when I say always, I'm talking three, four, 5 years old, somewhere in there. But I didn't know what that meant. I didn't understand it. I just knew that I didn't want to be inside playing with dolls. I wanted to be outside on the bike. I wanted to be doing the heteronormative things that we think of little boys want to do. I didn't realize that I would actually be able to change my gender, not in South Carolina, not maybe in the United States. I thought, you know, I'd have to go out to California or, you know, somewhere very open that everyone knows is an open place. As you get older, you realize open places, even a state as big as California, isn't always going to be accepting within its entire state. So I decided to stay home here, South Carolina. I transitioned here. I'm born and raised in South Carolina. After I left the Citadel, I did go into law enforcement, a local agency not too far from the Blossom Bridge, if you cross it. And I enjoyed it. I love the job. I started taking hormones in February of 2011. I changed my name in July of 2011. I had gender-affirming surgery in December of 2011, December 6th. December 15th, I had my birth certificate, my South Carolina birth certificate, changed to male. December 21st, I was fired. I'm sorry, I'm supposed to say I resigned. The things that we go through that have already been mentioned, you know, losing work, finding health care, finding just everyday things, these are already hard tasks when you don't want to confront your whatever your health issues may be. If you know that you have high blood pressure, but you really don't want to take that regimen every day, you really don't want to change what you're eating, you really don't want to make those changes, it's already hard enough as a person to just step into that doctor's office to change your life. So now add changing your gender on top of whatever other health issues you may already have. It's hard enough just to have the courage to step up and make that change for yourself. So when you go into a doctor's office and they're looking at you some kind of way, or, you know, asking me when I've had certain exams that I don't need to have, okay, it gets difficult when everywhere you go, you have to educate. Dana mentioned that it's naturally, we do that naturally. And a lot of it is, I want to educate so that I can be respected. But there are times when I just want to be respected. I don't want to have to educate you if I'm just going to the store, if I'm just going to the mall. I want to just be able to go get what I need to get and move on without going, oh, can you tell me why this? Can you tell me? I will, because I've made the decision to be an activist. In fact, I actually quit FedEx because that's where I went next. I actually just quit FedEx last month. And a lot of people are like, that's a good job. There's so many folks, trans folks, who don't have a job. Why would you do that? Because this is my life's work, and this is where I want my focus to and my dedication to be, is in the education portion. So that's a huge and scary step I took, but I did that because I know that that's what has to be done. But trans folks are no different than everybody else. Some of us have jobs, some of us don't. Some of us have a partner, some of us don't. Some of us have kids, some of us don't. When you talk about things that are stigmatized, a trans man carrying his own child, that's a huge battle. There are so many people who can't wrap their mind around it. Here's the simple answer to that. If you have a working womb, you can carry a child. That's it. There's no punchline. There's nothing else. That's it. You know, if you have ways and means to help someone create a child, that's it. It doesn't matter what your gender is. It doesn't matter how you identify. If you have the means to have and create life, have and create life. Even within the LGBT community, in the LGBT community, there are some people who don't understand. There are other trans men who really get upset about trans men having babies, saying that it makes the trans male community look bad. No. Okay, you know, I don't understand that. But we all have habits, we all have hobbies, we have likes, we have dislikes. Some of us like going to the movies, some of us like making movies, some of us like art, some of us don't like art. We're people. And at the end of the day, you get to know that person, and you go from there. It doesn't matter about, you know, their identity, their expression. If you're not sure, you can ask. But if you don't want to ask, you're afraid to ask, you're not sure how to phrase the question, it's really easy to just call someone by their name. If you're not sure. I use he, him, his pronouns. But if for some reason you weren't sure, and I told you my name is Greg, then you can just say Greg every time. That's one of the issues I had while I was in law enforcement. They were like, well, people don't know what to call you, Officer Green. There's no gender there. It's really that simple. There's no gender there. When we're talking about thinking outside of the gender box and how, you know, what to do, what are the next steps or things like that, what I would like to see from this and from any other, and everywhere I go when I'm speaking, and like I said, with the three of us pretty much, we roll around Columbia and anywhere else in the state where we got to go. What I would like to see is not just the, let's get together, let's learn, and let's, you know, I like to make people laugh. Not just let's laugh and oohs and ahs and like question. Let's do something. Let's be active in our response. What does that mean? Great question. What does being active in our response mean? On our end, if we're having an event, we need to put it out there. When it's out there, if you see it, attend. You can't attend, share. You can't share, I don't know why you couldn't share it, but not just with sharing the event. If you have the ability to, and this always gets, and we've definitely done this conversation, money. Something that simple. When we're doing things and we need to make flyers, we may not have a printer at home or a color printer or good paper. You have access to that or you want to help with that? Help. Those are the type of things that the community as a whole can do to help our community. If you don't fully understand, guess what? That's okay. You understand what I said when I said we might need flyers made, right? That was pretty clear, understandable. You don't have to get me 100%. But if you're like, oh, well, I understand this part. How can I help this part? Right now I'm working on a committee nationally for a national movement to have a transgender march to D.C. And we're getting busloads of people from everywhere in the country, busing people to D.C. to march to the Capitol. Every minority group has done this. And it's our time. It's our time to do it. Is it scary? Yes. Why is it scary? Are we going to be able to get everybody there? Are we going to be able to, you know, make sure people have food and snacks to get there, on the way there, on the way back? Are people going to have a safe place to stay? Are people going to show up who don't want this to happen so bad that they show up to kill us? See, that's our reality. When we step up as activists, when we go somewhere, it's not a matter of people with picket signs saying, don't do this, don't do that. People will kill us. I have been threatened more and felt threatened more in my transition than in my time in law enforcement. And that's pretty scary. Because then I had the tools I needed to defend myself. I had my little super bat belt. I don't have that anymore. So all I can use are my instincts and my speed. Duck and run. Duck and run. But these are the things that we're fearful for. These are the things that we want. You know, everybody's not the same. I very much am binary, meaning I very much identify as male. Male, trans male, either or. I don't have a problem with identifying as just male. I don't have a problem as identifying as transgender male because that is a part of my identity. I'm not taken away from who I was, but I'm not always going to say that depending on the setting that I'm in. We just want support in whatever way that means. So thank you all for being here, again, for having us, and I'll pass the mic over.
Thank you, Greg. Our final speaker is Linda Brennison. Linda has been a member of the UUCC since 2005 and currently serves on its Board of Trustees. Please welcome Linda. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, previous speakers. Well, my name is Linda, and I use the pronouns she and her. I'm here to talk with you about my personal experience and how I became a transgender ally. It was in 2006 that I began the long journey of becoming a trans ally. I never expected this exact thing to happen, but I knew something was coming. I had suspected for a long time that someone very close to me was not the person I had been taught to assume they were. I had no clue that their struggle involved their gender identity. And I also did not realize that the struggle had been going on for most of both of our lives. This person is my younger sibling. Looking back over our lives, I find that hindsight is 20/20. Right. My transgender sibling never seemed comfortable in their own skin. I, being a self-centered young person at the time, never thought about this deeply. Truly, until 2006, I really had no idea what transgender was. It took having a bad accident to force me into a better understanding of what it means to be transgender. In fact, you might say I first needed an ally myself in order to become an ally. It just so happened, as things often do in life, that just a short while after I learned that my sibling was transgender, I broke one ankle in three places, and at the same time, I badly sprained my other ankle. I was immediately incapacitated. I could not walk at all for weeks. I needed help. I was out of work for 4 months. So, guess who came to my aid? My transgender sister. From now on, I will refer to her as just my sister. Our first outings together were to the orthopedist. I was nervous at first, but then I observed how everyone accepted the gender presented to them. I practiced using the correct pronouns. I slipped and used the wrong pronoun only once. I was more horrified by this than my sister was. She has always been more kind and understanding than I. I have to tell you that when I first learned that my sister was transgender, I felt almost as though a loved one had died. I mourned. But it did not take me long to see how happy my sister was in her true gender identity. She was so much more relaxed, and our relationship was closer than it had ever been because we were now totally honest with each other, and she knew she could trust me. Now I find that when the two of us go out together, people easily accept us. No one has ever challenged us in any way. For my sister, that, unfortunately, has not always been the case. She had to change jobs because of the harassment she suffered, even though she had been a well-liked employee. She had to get a new job where no one knew her previously. She is very extroverted, but also sensitive to the fact that people may hate her just for being who she is. It is not an easy life. It is not a life you would choose unless it was the only honest life you could live. For people of my generation, very often, so much is lost because many years have been spent living a lie. Then, when the transgender individual comes to a point in life where they feel they must be honest about their gender identity, it does not always go well. Up until now, I have told you the rosier part of our family story. It is not all rosy. My sister lived many years in agony because she could not tell our parents that she was transgender. Only after they both died did she feel comfortable to tell me. My daughter and I are the only two family members who have accepted her. She has two sons who will not accept her, and she has grandchildren she has never even seen. This is a lot of sacrifice just to have your true gender identity acknowledged. It does not have to be that way. I am here today because I want to challenge fear and encourage understanding. As for me, let me assure you that the transgender person I love today is the same person I have loved since childhood. It is not hard to be an ally. Just be sensitive. Open up your heart and educate yourself. In conclusion, I would like to read a short excerpt from the website straightforequality.org. Rather than developing a stiff set of requirements or beliefs for someone to be an ally, straightforequality.org created a list of some of the qualities people, regardless of where they are on the ally journey, possess. First of all, allies want to learn, and I think that's why we're all here today. Allies are people who don't necessarily know all that can be known on LGBTQ issues or about people who are LGBTQ, but they want to learn more. Allies address their barriers. Allies are people who might have to grapple with some barriers to being openly and actively supportive of people who are LGBTQ, and they're willing to take the challenge. Allies are people who know that support comes in many forms. It can mean something super public. Think covering yourself in rainbow glitter and heading to a pride celebration with a sign reading, "Proud Ally." But it can also mean expressing support in more personal ways, through the language we use, conversations we choose to have, and signals that we send. I've heard those conversations, and I've seen those signals, people. And true allies know all aspects of ally expression are important, effective, and should be valued equally. Allies are diverse. Allies are people who know that there's no one way to be an ally and that everyone gets to adopt the term in a different way, and that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Okay, now is the portion where we're going to do Q&A. So there's note cards on your tables. If you have questions, can you please jot down the questions on the note cards and then just raise your hand and I'll come collect them for you. We do have a couple questions that were submitted beforehand. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Dana, who is our moderator, and she'll get started on those questions while you guys write.
While you're writing, I want to kind of review a document. The National Center for Trans Equality in 2015 did the U.S. Trans Survey. There was over 27,000 respondents, and it was the largest survey of the trans community ever. and as a critical survey. And there were over 200 respondents in South Carolina. So to give a kind of putting it in perspective what the experiences are of trans people in South Carolina, 10% of the respondents reported being unemployed. At that time, at the current time, the South Carolina unemployment rate was 5%. 28% stated they were living in poverty. The South Carolina poverty rate at that time was 12%. And then identity documents, only 9% of the respondents reported that their IDs had name and gender they preferred, while 80% reported that none of their ID documents had the name and the gender they preferred. The cost of changing IDs was one of the main barriers they faced, with 41% said they have not changed their legal identity, and 39% said they have not updated their gender IDs, reporting that they could not afford it. 35% of the respondents have shown that an ID with a name or gender did not match the gender presentation, were being verbally harassed, denied benefits or services, or asked to leave or assaulted. And the ID document, why there's two main reasons that it's an issue in South Carolina is that there is no legal official process for having your gender marker changed in South Carolina. There are unofficial policies that the people involved may or may not adhere to. Changing your name is a relatively easy process, but it is a court-ordered process. And so in South Carolina, you may or may not, I literally know two people, two trans women, ironically, both named Aaron, and I call it a tale of two Aarons, whereas one, she started her ID document changes in early, they both started in early December, actually. And one Aaron posted today that she just got back her Maryland birth certificate with her gender change. The other person is giving a runaround by DHEC, Vital Statistics, and the DMV, and saying, well, there's no policy, there's no change. So when these things are occurring, and I mean, people ask me when they come to me, what's going to happen when I do my name and gender marker change? And I say, I can't tell you what's going to happen because of an inconsistency and non-uniformity in the process. I think that is one thing to push. But then also that there are lawyers that don't want to see it change. I know one lawyer that actually charged one person over $1,500 to get her daughter's gender marker changed, whereas that could have been done fairly easily if South Carolina was a state that allowed an administrative process, whereas the Aaron that got it changed, Maryland is where she was born, and all she had to do was fill out an affidavit online and mail it to Maryland, and she got back her birth certificate within a few weeks. So I think that I see people deliberately either taking advantage of the process and preying upon the trans community for financial gain, or they just want to complicate the process just to make it difficult. Okay. We did receive some questions. I'm going to pose them to the panel, and then we will respond, or we'll respond accordingly. And one thing, the three of us, we are speaking from our own personal experiences. By no means is it a definitive experience. My experiences are not Greg's or Naomi's, and theirs are not mine. So one takeaway that I would encourage is that is that, well, you, oh, well, we heard the speaker. You meet someone else and you say, well, you heard the speaker, so therefore I know all about your life now. You don't. It's all individual. Each experience is very unique. There is no definitive human experience. There is no definitive transgender experience. So I'll just go through the questions and then we'll respond and just go through them. How do I approach respectively someone for whom I do not know what pronoun to use?
Whoever wants to take it. Yeah, okay. I was about to say, Greg, you look ready.
Okay, so real quick, I think it's just really important to keep in mind that pronouns are like names. In the same way that you won't walk up to me and say, hey, Elizabeth, hey, John, it's the same way you shouldn't walk up to me and just assume my pronouns. So I think it's just really important to make sure that if you do not know someone's pronouns, and I know that we are socialized and encouraged to just see someone, see how they present themselves and assign a pronoun to them. But as best you can, just try to use gender neutral language and just always ask someone for their pronouns if you don't know them.
Yeah. This kind of ends up being a follow-up on that one. If I mess up and misgender someone by accident, what's the best way to apologize? I guess.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's, oh, and I've had it happen so many times. It's like, especially early in transitions, and they go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, blah, 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 and they just ramble on, and I'm just like, yeah, as Greg would say, a simple sorry. Yeah. You made a mistake, do better. So. Mm-hmm. Why can women wear pants and polo shirts and not be labeled trans, but men can't wear a skirt? I'm going to give that to Naomi.
Okay, so as the feminist scholar on the panel, so I think it's really important to remember that masculinity is historically and culturally context specific, and it's always changing. And so there are cultures where men and males are allowed to wear things that resembles what we would call skirts. But in our context, that's highly discouraged, mostly because we live under a system called patriarchy. And in patriarchy, men are typically seen as male or as the default. So when you go to a bathroom, you see like the stick figure that's like coded as a male, then you see a triangle has to be added to that to make it into a female stick figure. And you see that male stick figure on traffic signs and everywhere else because humans are just, you know, in our patriarchal culture are just always assumed to be men and male. So when women do what men do, such as go into the workplace, wear pants, this is kind of like seen as them just humanizing themselves in a certain kind of way, or just accessing different forms of humanity. But gender roles for men are highly more regulated because masculinity is thought to be this special protected class of expression that's only available to one kind of people, which is men.
Yeah, it comes from conventions a lot, and I think this kind of next one I'll speak to and see if they want to, because it kind of, I heard it was not right to use the word transgendered. That's putting an ED on the end, but you should use the word transgender. Why? A lot of that is convention. Transgendered used to be a more common term used in the transgender community. I often still to this day, because that was the term, one of the terms when I first transitioned. Well, actually, that's part of it, is the word transition was not a common word in the community. So transgendered were people that were actively what we would say now in transition. And you would see, and I would identify myself and still do as a transgendered woman. But as conventions and language change, sometimes what's currently is not what becomes the best language. And I think in that regard, transgender versus transgender, transgender is the best language. But that also doesn't mean just because I should still be allowed to identify myself as, because it was my convention at the time, as a transgendered woman. And I noticed at one point I was like checking myself on that. And I'm going, I shouldn't be checking myself on my identity. But as far as the best language, transgender is the word. And I think that you may hear someone, because they identify a certain way, that they may not use what is considered the best language, but that's how they identify. There are still people that identify as transsexual, as a transsexual man or a transsexual woman. That's how they identify. And there have often been, it's usually well-meaning allies. I even had a well-meaning ally come at me and say, how can you do this? That's not right for, because then, and then the thing that infuriated me about this person was, well, I read you shouldn't use that word. But that is one way to police and invalidate within communities. And it's sad when internally communities marginalize each other. So, do either of you want to speak to that? Or okay, because that one's near and dear to me. And actually, someone here wrote a really good response one night. Laura, as somebody was up on there, they were coming at me with that. And Laura's a linguistics by profession, so she looked at it a linguistic profession and putting it in perspective. And it was just like, language changes and evolves, and I think that's the way to look at it. I think that's kind of a duplicate. How can we be the best allies? Is there a need for accompaniment to certain potential dangerous activities or events? I think so. At times, sometimes it becomes necessary. 3 years ago, we had a major event at the State House around a bill that was to basically... trans people would require trans people to use the restroom of their assigned, no matter how they present or how they look. I feel quite certain if someone walked in a women's restroom or saw Greg or a men's restroom that and saw me, they would probably, the first words out of their mouth, what are you doing in here? Because what had happened in other states where similar events had occurred, that people would actually make comments. They actually had one woman testify, like during the testimony, going, I just walked into that restroom and that person was in there with me and I felt threatened. And so basically attacked her. And so when we were at that event, when we were at the State House that day, just as kind of being proactive against something like that, Planned Parenthood actually furnished some of their clinic accompaniers to actually accompany each trans person when we went to the restroom, so that if someone tried to pull that stunt, and that it is a stunt, that there was a witness to be there. So some trans people feel that they need a bathroom buddy because they're afraid of their own well-being. They talk about trans people being the threat in the restroom, whereas you cannot find a single documented case of a trans person assaulting someone in a restroom, but you can find countless cases of where a trans person has been assaulted in a restroom We just had a case not too long ago in North Carolina where a trans woman was assaulted by two cisgender women in a restaurant. So those spaces are not necessarily safe for trans people.
That sounds awesome. Definitely get that set up. Part of what Dana was mentioning about the bathroom buddies, they were actually pens. And I don't remember what they said, but I'll go with you.
I need to pee, and I'll go with you.
Right.
Yeah.
So there were like pens, basic ally pens, so you would wear, like if you were somewhere knowing there was a mixture of trans and cis people, you could wear a pen that just said, I'll go with you. And we knew that meant, okay, you know, I could come to, you know, say, hey, I need to go to the bathroom, you mind, you know. So pens, you know, that's just something. And another way, when you're talking about allies, another way is not necessarily being in a place where we are, but being where you are. What I mean by that is when you hear negative conversations or you hear things being said, we may be nowhere near you. It could be a restaurant, you know, just casual somewhere. And the way the news is these days, it could be a part of a conversation coming from something on TV. And as an ally, that is your window of opportunity to say, hey, you know what, actually, you shouldn't say that. That's not okay. Here's another way to think about that. Or what if someone said that about you, you know, and change it there. See, once you change the behaviors like that, two things happen. One, that person now knows you're an ally, and they don't know why. They may question you or question people that you know or that are around you, but they don't know why, but they know you're an ally, and they know that they can't have that conversation around you. And so your presence will adjust their mindset of what they feel comfortable talking about, and at some point, they won't feel comfortable talking about it anymore. Whether they choose to continue to educate themselves or not, their comfort level won't be at a point where they can speak of certain things.
Two things right quick. Lynn, when you asked that question, you ended it saying you guys, and you guys is not a gender-neutral term. I think it's really important to remember that allyship has to be intersectional. So that means that as transgender folks, that we exist in multiple different identity categories, including racial categories, categories of citizenship status and disability and other things. So supporting us also means supporting us in all the different ways in which we can be marginalized. So that means also supporting racial justice and also supporting disability justice and all the other ways that transgender people exist, so that we can maneuver through this world in a way that's like safe for us.
And I think just standing up, two instances that come to my mind, and social media, right? But right now, social media is toxic. But two instances that recall. 3 years ago, LTX did a profile on me that ran, and I was shocked. It was about 10 minutes long on a nightly newscast. But they run an hour. They run an hour news, so they do have time to do that. But they then the comments on their Facebook page started, and some people hit me up. But by the time I got to the page, I didn't need to say anything because my friends had already said what needed to be said. And the other is similar. When I for some of you may not even be aware of the fact. I actually ran for state senate last fall, and supporting that candidacy, the people that stood up and promoted my candidacy, and also the way it was reacted on social media. Again, locally, I think that people are pretty much used to seeing me in the news. But the upstate, not so much. When Channel 4 out of Greenville ran it, that was kind of an eye-opening back to the way things, they actually turned off the comments because it just got so toxic. But which actually just shows that sometimes Columbia is not perfect, but it's not, yeah, as bad. But I think it's just saying those and making comments. Or when you hear someone say, "I'd never vote for a man wearing a dress," and referring to either myself or other trans female, trans feminine candidates. So I think it's just when you're being an ally and then don't make your allyship about you either. That it's getting to the point where you start telling the people in the community how to behave. I think that's when allyship goes wrong. So, this one's going to go back to Naomi, because would the act of declaring X forms where gender is required be helpful, supportive of trans people?
Yes, that is very helpful. It's necessary. It allows, first and foremost, it is an institutional dismantling of the gender binary system. And in our institutions are one of the ways in which the gender binary system really comes to life. When you literally have to comport your identity or your body in a certain kind of way to be recognized in a hospital, to be recognized at the DMV, and so on. So having that option available is very helpful for transgender folks, but it's also really helpful for cisgender folks as well.
While I've got you, this one's directed specifically to you. Do you find it useful in any of the cases to engage with people who are militantly opposed to even considering transgender other than a binary people to be equal?
Not directly, but in other ways, yes. Me personally, I'm not necessarily interested where I am, like in my life right now and with my activism, I'm not necessarily interested in arguing with someone whether or not I'm human or whether or not I should be recognized as such. But I do respond to those questions in other kind of ways, through my writings, through just my public life, and also through my academic work.
Can you share a significantly gender-affirming experience? I figured let's go for something a little on more of the uptick. I'll start with myself. The one that immediately comes to my mind was when I originally attended the University of South Carolina, I was still presenting male. And I transitioned after I graduated. And for one of the first times I went back to the university, just to meet and talk with the professors, one particular professor who I had for my directing classes, I was in his office and we discussing. And he asked me, he said, "Can I make an observation?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "You just seem so much more at ease and calm with yourself." And just to say that, because so many people talk about trans people like hiding something, but no, they're not. They're letting out. It's not hiding what we used to be. It's becoming what we truly are. So, and to get that affirmation was really good from Professor O'Connor. So.
I would say the most gender-affirming experiences I have, the way that I present my gender can range from a look that is really close to my assigned gender to looks that are like very, very feminine. And the most gender-affirming experiences I have is those days when I really don't feel like doing like hair or makeup or wearing anything that's traditionally conceived of being feminine, and someone and a friend will walk up to me and be like, "Hey girl." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, thank you. Hi."
For me, I would say the first time my dad introduced me to someone as his son. Because I know he was struggling with it at that time. I know he, first of all, tries to figure out, what did he do, right? What did I do that, to make you this way? What didn't I do to make you this way, right? So I know that he struggles with that. And we took the car to a mechanic. It's a mechanic he's been seeing for years. So I know the mechanic probably knows of me previously. And my dad was just like, you met my son Greg before, right? And I don't remember the guy's – I know his name now, but at the time I didn't even remember what his name was, because I was just like, whoa. You know, I know that was really intense for him. And we're good now. We're to the point now we kind of joke, because I tell him, I said, you know, there are sometimes I can still tell – And I will only do this with him, but I can tell I'm still daddy's girl, because, like, if something happens, immediately, where are you? What's wrong? You need me to come get you? I mean, he goes straight into it. When he's talking about my brother, you know, he was like, yeah, his car broke down. I told him he need to call somebody, but if it's me, he's on the way. And so I know that, I feel like that's why he's still that way with me, but he still respects me as his son. And so for me, that was my moment.
I think this may have come out about my comment about where I was going for my surgery. It said, can you get transgender surgery anywhere in the United States? And yes, but there are so few competent, qualified physicians that actually do it. Me personally, I think there's really only two really good ones. There are others that do it. But part of the reason why those particular ones that I recommend, but their waiting lists are years long. There's a doctor in Pennsylvania and a doctor in California. The reason why I recommend them is because they are transgender themselves. Dr. Christine McGinn in Pennsylvania and Marcy Bowers in California. There are other surgeons that perform gender affirmation surgeries. But the thing is, though, that also, when we say the surgery, it's not just genital reconstructive. It can be many things. Some trans, especially trans women, may have facial contouring done. Breast augmentation for trans women. Chest reconstruction for trans men. And so and that's just like the tip of the iceberg. There are so many other procedures that form under what I refer to as gender affirming surgeries. It's just that the waiting lists and the finances, and also what's happening now is that because insurance is now starting to cover gender affirmation surgeries, more doctors are getting involved, but their experience is lacking. And for the first time in probably decades, we are having trans people complain about unsatisfactory results because they went to inexperienced surgeons. And it's just because it's being overwhelmed. And that's another reason why I was scheduled to go to Thailand for my surgery. There are actually more qualified, experienced surgeons in Bangkok than there are in the entire United States. And there's probably about two dozen at least qualified experienced surgeons in Bangkok alone. So, sure.
Okay. Just very quick, I wanted to add to Dana's point, that particularly for like young transgender folks that I know, getting gender affirming surgeries are very inaccessible to them because of the cost. A lot of younger transgender folks might not have full-time jobs, so might not have health insurance and so on. And so although the resources, like as Dana was saying, was pointing out, to actually get gender affirming surgeries can be really limited, there's a whole entire black market of gender affirming surgeries that's going on, that people sometimes out of desperation feel like they have to interact or engage with. And that black market of gender-affirming surgeries has caused a number of fatalities for a lot of people.
And I want to touch on the idea of gender-affirming surgeries. It's not always about genital reconstruction or chest reconstruction, like Dana mentioned. For me, just a simple hysterectomy, I mean, that right there is something that would be considered gender-affirming. So it's not – so, you know, we're thinking outside the box, right? So it's not necessarily that far outside the box. Sometimes it's actually still in the box that we know of. That's not a – you know, that's not a surgery that – is uncommon, you know, so.
Yeah, and kind of in perspective on that, as far as insurance, my employer, up until about 3 years ago, 2 years ago actually, did not cover trans health care. They actually had very specific exclusions in the policy. One stated that would definitely not cover surgery. That was pointedly excluded. And the other was that anything relating to gender identity disorder, which is an antiquated medical term, gender dysphoria. And I spent 5 years going back and forth with my employer to the point, I actually filed an EEOC suit. And the EEOC found in my favor, but still my employer drugged their heels for 2 years, even once the EEOC had it. And so it's not something that just is immediately assumed to be there. So there are so many barriers in healthcare for trans people. Are problems different for white versus non-white trans people? I would say absolutely. I know my experiences are not anywhere near what Greg and Naomi experienced, and I'll just leave it at that and let them speak on it from there.
I know you got a lot.
Yeah, either one.
You got it.
Okay. Yeah, the experiences between white transgender people and transgender people of color, it varies extremely. And that only compounds when you add other complexities such as socioeconomic status, level of education, disability status, and so on. For me personally, as a black transgender person, and I see that a lot of times the discrimination that I faced based on my race is kind of inflected with the discrimination that I face being a transgender person as well. And so it's like just like this interlocking kind of compounding form of discrimination. I know that when I speak to white transgender friends, they can go to, there's a lot more resources available to them. The people in charge of the few resources that are here and are out there are owned and operated and funded by white folks. There are extremely small number of black trans organizations, and here in the Southeast, most of them are either out west or up north, and so there's definitely a discrepancy in terms of resources that we have available to us, but then also the way that our communities respond to us are like really different. I know that here in Colombia, for example, last year there was a black transgender youth I know who committed suicide by jumping off of a bridge here in Colombia, and their name was Dez. And Dez was 17 years old when they committed suicide. They were just like got accepted into college. And I remember, I didn't know Dez personally, but I knew people who knew Dez. And I remember when I was speaking to them about, like, you know, what was going on with him and, what his motivations would have been. I remember folks just keep telling me, like, you know, well, you know, his parents just wouldn't accept him as hard as, like, he wanted them to, as much as he tried to get them to accept him for who he was. His parents just would not accept him. And when you are a person of color and you're already, like, facing all of those other forms of marginalization and you add being transgender on top of that, it's just like, wow, it's just overwhelming for folks, especially young folks. So just in my experience, there definitely is differences, and a lot of those differences tends to be in the way that our communities respond to us, but also what resources we have access to.
This one's addressed specifically to you, Greg. If a person can do everything they are comfortable with, is there a need to do physical transformation? What is it that makes it important to do that?
So it's about the individual. It's about the individual. What is it that that person needs to be comfortable? Can I see it just to make sure I want to phrase this right? So if a person can do everything they are comfortable with, is there a need to for physical transformation? That physical transformation is a part of everything they need to be comfortable. I hope that makes sense. It's important because when you don't see a way out, your way out may be that bridge that Naomi just talked about. That might be your only way out. If you can't physically be who you know you are, you can't physically show that, and then you see people who have been fighting in this community for as long as we have or longer, you know, there's not a lot of, there may not be a lot of hope to offer that person. So, you know, if you can present physically how you want, that might be the hope that gets you through the day. When I first started my transition, there were times when, I mean, I lost my job, my house was in foreclosure, I was in a relationship for 8.5 years, that ended. Everything that could go went. But the only thing that kind of kept me pushing, every now and then I'd look in the mirror and I would see the changes happening. I would see who I am now. I would see myself becoming physically Greg. And that was enough to keep me going. So sometimes that physical is all that's needed. Just like the affirmation Naomi mentioned, when you're not necessarily trying all that hard because you're just not in the mood for it. And someone says, hey, girl, those are the things that can keep you pushing, and that's why it's important.
And also I wanted to mention that sometimes the change isn't in here. Sometimes the change has to happen outside of us. My personal non-binary experience, I'm comfortable presenting in a way that's close to my assigned gender. I'm also comfortable presenting in a way that's more feminine. But I know that irrespective of how I feel comfortable presenting, if I do present as my assigned gender, I'm going to be hazered. I'm going to be assigned the pronouns of he. So sometimes it's not about what I need to do or what transformations I need to take place internally to make me feel comfortable. And sometimes, and it seems to me to be the case that, in fact, the world itself just has to transform in order for trans people to completely be able to be themselves.
Okay. Well, since this was the only one that's addressed to me, so I'll take that and use that to kind of wrap it up. How much of teen suicide do you attribute to the trans youth issues that they face? We do know that as far as suicide in general, I think Laura mentioned it, the suicide ideation rate among trans people is over 40%, whereas the national average is less than 5%. And with teens, there's actually the trans student educational resources. They have a graphic up there that if trans youth are in a supportive environment at home or not, And in the non-supportive environment, the suicide rate jumps up to that 40-something percent. And in a supportive home, it's the national average. It's like 2 or 3%. So being that supportive, I mean, the whole trans youth, they need, and trans people in general, an entire support network. But for trans youth, it starts at home. And if they are not in a supportive home environment, that puts them at risk for so many others. So I think looking at it that way, that we have to be supportive of all trans people. And trans youth need the support in the home environment. Whereas someone like myself got out and was kind of self-supportive and self-sufficient when I transitioned, even though I did spend a year of unemployment the first year after I transitioned, but that's not, the home environment was probably something I could have, well, and for a while lived without my family. But for a youth, they need that family support. So I want to thank all of you for having us. I appreciate this. I will be around, and I'll kind of let each person just do a closing argument, or not closing argument, closing remarks. Unfortunately, one of my effects for my stroke, I have slight dysphagia, so I'll say the wrong word. So closing remarks, I think what the trans community needs is support. As the three of us know personally, we can't do everything, but I think we're expected to do everything. But there's only so much that a handful of people can do to help an entire community. So.
Okay, so for my closing remarks, I'm just going to raise awareness about two important campaigns that's going on right now. So one of which is the campaign of Kanonica Brown, who is a black trans woman in the state of North Carolina, who has had gender-confirming, according to what she defines as gender-confirming surgery, has undergone that process, has legally changed her name, but the state of North Carolina will not take her out of a male prison. And so she's currently trapped in a male prison right now and is extremely in fear of her life and her safety being in there. So if anyone wants any information about Kanonica Brown and how to plug into that campaign, I will be more than happy to share that information with you. Another campaign, if you have the capacity to do so, is a close friend of mine named Liso. She's a student in Namibia. She's black and non-binary as well. Liso was recently outed to her community, and right now she lives. Namibia is a country where being LGBTQ is literally illegal, punishable by prison sentences. So Liso is someone who desperately needs help right now as well, and so I've been raising a lot of awareness about those two campaigns and. Some of the ways in which you can help trans people is by giving direct support, whether that's by spreading information about our campaigns, donating financially if you can. So if you would like to hear any more about any of those two campaigns, I'll be more than happy to talk to you about it one-on-one.
And again, I also want to say thank you. I do have a few of my business cards. If you have any further questions or if you have any event outside of here that you would like to have, I have business cards to share, and that's it.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I just want to thank my beloved community, the UUCC, for your open minds. I'm going to steal from the Methodist, and your open hearts, which we really do have, and it's a pleasure to be here and to have your support. Thank you.
Of course, I want to thank all of our speakers today for bringing their time and expertise. And now I turn to you. Your homework is to, they've told you, they've answered so many questions for you. Now go home, read books, read articles, watch videos, educate yourself, please.